Okay, we'll come to order and welcome to the Civil Justice Committee. I'm Joe Mullery, the chair. Moving behind you over there is Gail Kula-Jackson, the vice chair. And I think the first thing we'll do is just start around and introduce ourselves. I'm Joe Mullery, as I already said, from North Minneapolis, the north half. We have over here the south half, who will introduce himself in a second. Gail, do you want to just very short introduction?
Sure. I'm Gail Kula-Jackson from Elect Minnesota
16A,
and very pleased to be back here.
And why don't we just, Deb, do you want to
start? Deborah Hillstrom. I represent all of the City of Brooklyn Center and parts of Brooklyn Park.
Pardon me. I forgot to mention, somebody's got cell phones on. We're getting noise, so please shut your cell phones off. Okay, go ahead, Melissa.
I'm Melissa Hartman. I represent portions of Coon Rapids and portions of Brooklyn Park.
I represent Tim Mahoney. I represent 67A, which is the northeast corner of the city of St. Paul.
Representative Dave Owen. I represent the northwest corner of the state, way up.
Sheldon Johnson. I represent the other half of the district that Tim Mahoney's in, sort of.
Sort of.
I'm Mary Liz Holberg. I represent most of Lakeville.
And Peggy Scott. I represent all of Andover except for one precinct and all of Ham Lake.
Cedar Scott. I'm from Wabasha. I represent the northern part of Winona County, southern half of Wabasha and Goodhue County.
And Steve, I believe you're the lead Republican.
Hi, Tim Kelly. I represent Camp Falls, Redland, Lake City, Goodhue area.
Corey Westrom. I represent Alexandria Morris, Elder Lakes, my hometown, western Minnesota.
Bobby Champion. I represent the southern part of North Minneapolis, the North Loop, and the half of downtown Minneapolis.
We sort of have areas covered. We have the east side of St. Paul all covered. We have North Minneapolis totally covered, and then the mixed suburb, Brooklyn Center, and Brooklyn Park is also the mixed suburb after that. So I don't know if we're quite regionally dispersed around the state. Then would the staff, Vicki, do you want to?
I'm Vicki Benson. I'm the committee legislative assistant for this committee. If you should ever need any assistance, please feel free to email me or give me a call at any time.
I'm Patrick Fullen. I'm the committee administrator. Same goes for me if you need any help.
Matt Gehring from the House Research Department. I'm from the nonpartisan office, so I can provide assistance with bill drafting and amendments at your request.
I'm Kate
Luther. I'm Dennis Bird. I'm on Republican Research. This is my 11th year on this committee.
And would our two pages introduce themselves? Okay, thanks. I believe that's all the introductions. Okay, then what we are going to do today is, because this committee is going to have some issues on data practices, and most people, unless you've been on this committee before, are not too familiar with the Chapter 13 and the issues involved in that. So rather than waiting until we get the bill and then trying to explain from day one, we're going to go over the basics of that today. And the first presenter is Lori Beyer-Kropinski, who's the Director of Information Policy Analysis Division in the Department of Administration. And I can never remember her name, so she's given me a little drawing which shows a crow in a pen on Steve. she has that ready for all of those of us who don't remember her name or can't pronounce it.
Chair, where will Vicki be keeping that?
Race for your amendments on the one bill. the daily amendment I expect from you on every bill. And then after that, we'll have Dave Johnson, who's head of PrimNet with the BCA. Laurie, would you just go ahead and start?
Yep, Mr. Chair and members, and I really will respond to just about anything. LGK, Laurie, just Hey You works really well, too. But it's good to see a lot of familiar faces as well as a lot of new faces. As Representative Mulry mentioned, I direct the Information Policy Analysis Division at the Department of Administration, and Dave Johnson with BCA is also here. I'm going to do an overview of the Data Practices Act, and then Dave's going to give you a little bit more detail on how data practices impact law enforcement. But before we start, we're going to take a quiz. So you should all have a handout. And I have candy because I'm giving you a quiz. I figured this might be my only opportunity so that it could be, I could give you a test and it could all be about me. So I have candy just to sweeten it a little bit, given the time of day that we might need it. Now, one of the other purposes of the quiz, I was preparing for this presentation and Mr. Neumeister told me I shouldn't be boring. And that everyone really needs to understand how data practices is just as important now as it was 30-odd years ago when it was passed. So we're going to use my data as an example, but go ahead and take 2 minutes just to give it your best guess on the handout. It will look like data practices quiz. So take your best guess. You can change your answers as we go along, and once they've done, we'll go through the answers and see how you all do. And I want Matt to take it, too. Has everyone found it? It will take 2 minutes.
Is that what you sent me by email?
Yes.
Okay.
And members, you can also compare answers because I see Representative Fortman doing that. So that's a very know your resources and go to them.
Just trying to see.
Does that affect the law license?
No. I can see an ethics complaint going in.
It depends.
Is
it void or voidable?
I'm retired.
Okay, Representative Mulry says we're all ready. We're going to get started. One of the things, my office is for shorthand known as iPad, and we are a very small office. So you, one of the other handouts you have in your packet just kind of gives you an overview of what we do with 4.5 staff. But we provide data practices and open meeting law assistance to over 12,000 people a year. And our customers include both citizens, the media, state and local government, as well as legislators, which is probably the part that you're going to care the most about. One of the things we do is kind of unique is that we will frequently testify about the impact of a particular bill. This is a very complex area, so oftentimes we'll be here to say, how do we make your bill work with existing state and federal law? What are going to be the unintended consequences of a particular action, and how do we get it to work right? So that's one of the things you will frequently see us up here. And I don't want you ever to think that we're testifying against other entities' bills or an author's bill. We're just trying to make sure that whatever you pass really works and does what you intended to do. So we provide legislative drafting to citizen groups and anyone else who will ask us, including legislators. And hopefully our role will make more sense as you learn more about the Data Practices Act. As I might have mentioned, data practices sometimes has a bad reputation. It is certainly a complex area of law, but there's a lot of really simple features that make it, just like snow in Minnesota, something that you got to love about this state that makes it really special. And there are just a couple things that I want you to walk away with today. Just, you know, 3-4 simple things that I just want you to always remember, and that you will be, you know, a lot of steps ahead in the data practices realm. One of the most important things you might want to know is data practices doesn't apply to you. It doesn't apply to the legislature or the judicial branch. So that's an important feature. It applies to government entities in Minnesota, so your state agencies, school districts, state and local governments, so your cities and counties and your watershed districts. It applies to those folks. It also applies to the U of M and other big public institutions like that, but not the judicial branch and not you. You have your own rules of public access, as well as the courts do. Government data. We have a lot of acronyms in this area and a lot of very specialized defined terms. Government data is anything that's in recorded format. So your paper files, your CDs, your discs, your videotapes. If I write my office strategic plan on a cocktail napkin and I write it all down, that's government data too. So think of anything that's kind of written down or recorded in some way. One of the things that makes Minnesota, I think, the most special is our presumption, and this is one of the things that I want you to always remember as you're looking at bills. Our presumption is that all data is public, unless it's not. And some of the examples where all data isn't public, where we kind of reverse the presumption, is in, say, educational data or personnel data. Active criminal investigations is also another area where you think the presumption is really flipped around. And Dave's going to give you some more examples of kind of the law enforcement context when he gets up here. So we have a lot of public data in Minnesota, probably a lot more than in other places. And one of the other features of our law is that anyone can do anything they want with public data, for the most part, as long as it's legal. So if I want to open a new business and I want to be able to market it, I can go to a variety of government entities, get the names and addresses of people, and go out and market my services. Completely okay to do. If you all wanted to get names and addresses of people and then go out and fundraise them, completely legitimate. You can do anything you want with public data. So that's an important thing for us all to remember. And one of the powers that you have held on to for yourself is, if all our data is public, unless it's not, that means that any time someone wants to protect or classify data, they have to come here. They have to come to the legislature so that you can make that decision. And also, if data is going to be protected, then no sharing of that can happen unless you, the legislature, say it can happen. So people are going to keep on coming here year after year because they either have data they want to share or data they want to protect and then want to share it for a certain purpose with someone. So one of the things we like to see, so this is the It's All About Me presentation, is when you are working on bills, never forget the presumption. And try, if you can avoid it, not to do a list of listing out things that are going to be public. You don't need to do that. We've got a presumption that says everything's public. So if you want to protect certain things, you put those down. You don't need to have any partial list of what's public data because our law already says that that's already taken care of. Any questions so far? Okay. When you're also, when everyone comes to you and wants to say, I need to protect this data or I want to share it, there's a balancing test, a three-legged stool, if you can think of it that way. What you balance in this area is government needs data to do their work. And sometimes when agencies come forward and say they want to collect certain data from the public, we're going to say, do you really need to do that to do your work? That's one piece. The government needs information. The second piece is the public's right to know. Everything should be open. The last leg of the stool is individual privacy rights. My desire to not have everyone know everything about me. So as you look at all these proposals as far as who's going to share or what's going to be protected, you're looking at those three things. The government's need for it, public's right to know, and individual privacy rights. So it's always that three-legged stool, and in different instances, we have balanced those things in different ways. And I suppose predatory offenders is one of those areas where you say, we've decided, the legislature has decided that they deserve less privacy because it is in all of our best interest to know more about them. So they'd be one of those examples. In this area, there's a number of federal, big federal laws that kind of impact what you can do, and that'll be another thing that I'll come up to the table and say, I know you really want to authorize this sharing between law enforcement and schools, but the federal law is going to prevent you from doing that because they've really preempted the field. So there are a couple of really big federal laws. FERPA is one in the educational area. HIPAA, you might have all heard of as well. That one's unique because it just kind of sets the floor and then allows states to be more conservative and more protective. And then also the Driver's Privacy Protection Act, which impacts driver and motor vehicle records. Those are some of the big ones, but there are often other federal laws that might impact how you can do what you want to do. Now, why is data practice important? If you've seen my quiz, you've seen a little bit about how much government data is out there about just me or any of us, any of your constituents. This law was passed in the 70s, really in the aftermath of Watergate, the J. Edgar Hoover secret files, and how is that just as relevant today? You know, I wouldn't have thought in this country that there would still be perhaps secret prisons, secret databases, and secret arrests, but you know what? Some of these things are just perennial. This law is about government accountability and how when we do our government work, if there is sunshine and openness and transparency, that we just do our work a little bit better and that as taxpayers, people get to know and see how their government operates. So I think especially in this electronic age, data practice is just as important, if not more so, because now we have data spills. It's not just a file cabinet that gets lost. It's a flash drive that has, you know, a million records on it. We all see security breaches every day, so we know that the impacts to individual people. It can go on the internet and be out there for everyone to see. And how do we continue to balance privacy and the public's right to know? Okay. The three things for you to remember that will help you with your quiz. Presumption is all data is public. Only you decide what data is going to be protected and how it's going to be shared. And then you've got that three-legged stool, hopefully, to help you make those decisions. I'm now going to turn it over to Dave so that he can talk about law enforcement. He gets more of the jazzy stuff. I admit that. And then we'll go over your quiz and see how you do. And I don't have any prizes other than the candy for the person who gets the most right. So we'll see if it's if Representative Holberg gets the most right, which I bet she might.
I have a question before. Do you still give, I know when your predecessor, I don't know if you had the same title, but they gave advice to not just the state, but to all local government. Do you still do that?
Mr. Chair members, yes. Cities and counties, all local government, all government who's subject to the act, we give advice to, as well as citizens who might be interacting with any of those same agencies.
How do you find the response in general? I guess I have an interest in it because many public schools interpret it different than every other school district in the state, and I'm wondering, is that very common or just a quirk is typical?
Mr. Chair members, and that's one of the things we might also comment on too, is since we take so many of the questions from state and local government, if you pass something where we're sure that people are just right off the bat going to misinterpret what you intend, we might try and help you pass law that gets it clear, more clearly, maybe less with less ambiguity to it. But there are certain areas where FERPA, the Federal Educational Rights and Privacy Area, is so complex in how it interacts with state law. Many school districts have different interpretations based on their risk tolerance for how they do it. But there are also things like directory information for schools and students and parents where different school districts get to make different decisions about how much is going to be public about their students. So that's something where the law purposely says schools are allowed to be different and make different decisions about that.
Is that federal or state then?
The directory information, that's federal. Federal law.
Does anybody else have questions before we move on? Okay. Mr. Johnson, do you want to take over?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I feel somewhat at a disadvantage because I didn't bring any treats, and I didn't bring a test. So that's not been a part of any of my legislative appearances in the past. So I'll make sure they are in the future. It's a pleasure for me to be here. I'm the executive director of MNJIS, which now is the former CJIS and the CRIMNET program office merged into Minnesota Justice Information Services. And I've been with the state now for a year. Prior to coming to the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension in the state of Minnesota, I spent my first 20 years as a police officer in the city of Brooklyn Park. I left there as the deputy chief, and then I went to the city of Blaine, where I was the police chief and the safety services manager. So I did the police department, the fire department, code enforcement, and lots of other things that were very interesting. One of the things over the years that I've been involved in is being a data practices practitioner. And as such, I've taught many law enforcement agencies how to write data practices plans, how to come into compliance with the Data Practices Act, which is a little bit more difficult than one might think just at face value. And I'd like to chime in very quickly on a couple of things that Lori has indicated. And certainly we all understand that there is a presumption that all data in Minnesota are public. There's another side of that that says unless another rule or law says it's other than public. And as a practitioner, one of the difficulties that you run into is that an individual who's making a request for data, whether it's comprehensive law enforcement data or any other data that's in the possession of government, only has to make the request because the presumption is public. It's then up to the individual who receives that request to understand the full range of law, whether it's federal law or whether it's state law, that may say that that field or that data that's being requested or that element of data is other than public. So the various classifications and the various decision points in making that determination do not all exist in Chapter 13 of Minnesota state law. So while it would seem maybe somewhat easy to decide, it really is a little bit more complex than that because of the width and breadth of knowledge that one needs to have when being confronted with a data request. And then the other side of that issue is because there are penalty provisions within the framework of the Data Practices Act in which a person who's making a decision regarding data can be in violation of the Act itself for not providing data that they should have provided or for providing data that they should not have provided. So it's one of these issues where it can be very daunting as a government official to try to comply with the law and make sure that individuals are entitled to either protection or access. Have either of those accomplished? And so it does become sometimes a rather complex issue. And I like very much the analogy that Lori gave in regard to the three-legged stool, with one minor exception, that when it comes to comprehensive law enforcement data, there's a little bit of a leg that sort of comes down. So it's like a three-and-a-half-leg stool. And that is that there are certain requirements within the framework of 1382 comprehensive law enforcement data that clearly indicate that the legislature was concerned that the right to access to data is appropriately balanced with the ability of the law enforcement community to meet their public safety challenges. And that's why you see some difference in 1382 that's a little bit different than what you may see in some of the other provisions. And I don't know whether you all got this handout that I had typed up, and this is sort of an easy chart on what's public law enforcement data pursuant to Minnesota Statute 1382. And essentially, members, subdivisions 2, 3, and 6 in 1382 identify the various fields of data that are public at all times that are collected by law enforcement agencies in the state of Minnesota. And so you can see that I don't want to take up time in front of this committee to go through the various elements, but if you look down from whether it's arrest data, request for service data, or response or incident data, you will see those fields of data that, as a general rule, are public upon inquiry. Remembering, please, that when you're making a public inquiry, it's those inquiries are at reasonable times and reasonable places, and the law also provides a reasonable amount of time to respond to that public inquiry. I think we all know that the nature of law enforcement and the types of incidents and actions that law enforcement responds to creates a significant amount of interest in the community, in with decision makers, and certainly within the media, because those types of events are heavily reported and certainly have got great impact on the various communities in the state of Minnesota. And so comprehensive law enforcement data are one of those inquiries that for whatever reason seems to come in 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And I can tell you, having been a deputy chief in one community and a chief in another, every news media agency had my home phone number, had my pager, and when a significant event took place, they would call in regard to getting information regarding that event. And of course, the access to that information was the Data Practices Act. Now, as we move forward with comprehensive law enforcement data, if you turn to the second page, it will also give you some fields of data that are protected, especially in the area of identities, the identities of those people we serve, those people we have contact with, and those people who provide information to us. I'm sure it's not surprising to members of this committee that individuals who provide data to law enforcement so law enforcement can do their job are significantly concerned about who may have access to that data. And it doesn't take much to understand with some of the events that law enforcement is investigating why individuals would be concerned as they provide data that access might be protected, that their identity might be protected because of the possibility of retaliation and what may come to them because they are identified, even just from general public knowledge. And as you move down that sheet, there are some specific exemptions that the legislature has put in to law enforcement data. One of those exemptions is that, of course, comprehensive law enforcement data, that covered by 1382, only applies to agencies that carry on a law enforcement function. 911 calls at one time were public, and the recordings and the voice were public. After a number of significant incidents, the legislature revisited that a few years ago, and the recordings are not public, but a transcript of those recordings can be if the requester pays the fee for making that transcription available. Investigative data, that data that is gathered by law enforcement in the furtherance of a criminal charge, as a rule is confidential, generally is confidential, but can be made available to the victims of criminal acts or alleged criminal acts so long as, and it's made available through a prosecuting authority, so long as that access either does not compromise an ongoing investigation or is not going to be used to engage in unlawful activities. The main one of those would be retaliation.
Do you mind if there's questions?
No, I'm sorry, sir.
I have a question. On a 9/11 call, so if somebody calls reporting a crime, then either the person or members of his gang can find out who that caller was then. That's just an enormous issue, you know, in North Minneapolis, it's a big issue. How to stay how to stay from having the criminal or his gang find that out, I understand that's going to be covered next or something.
Is
that
Mr. Chair, I want to make sure that I haven't confused two of the issues. The identity of a person who placed a 911 call or the identity of a telephone number of a service subscriber whose phone is used to place a 911 call can be protected. So that is not general public information. What I was referring to, Mr. Chair, was the actual recording. Every 911 center makes a voice recording. And you probably, members of this committee, have heard that on various news. And when someone calls in 911 and is in horror or is screaming and is making a report, at one time those recordings were public and they no longer are.
Okay. Just question follow up on that. If I call and say that the house just north of me is, there's a shooting going on or something, can they get that then, even though they can't get my name and address? They can identify me with the information in the call.
Mr. Chair, members, that identity is not public. Of a person who makes the 911 call, that identity can be protected.
So parts of the transcript can be audited out then that would identify.
That is correct.
Okay, thank you.
That part of a transcript which identifies would be audited out.
Representative Champion?
One question, Mr. Johnson. Perhaps you're going to answer this later. It appears to me that an alias that is used by a person during the commission of maybe identity theft is something that is public, and therefore wouldn't that to some degree harm the person who's the innocent person who now becomes a victim over and over again, because this information, I guess, if the presumption is true, is that it's public.
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair and Representative, in any case, on an ongoing investigation, we have certain elements which are always public, but at the conclusion of that investigation, and that conclusion is defined by a prosecuting attorney declining charges, the investigating agency inactivating the case and not furthering the investigation, or the matter is completed in court, then the preponderance of all of that investigative material becomes public. And the identities of people involved in that would also become public unless they qualified pursuant to statute for protection.
Just as a follow-up, Jim. So just for clarity, if I am a victim, somebody uses my name, so then that means that whenever someone goes and put in my name, Bobby Champion, for an example, then I will always be connected to this person or this individual who perhaps was involved in some criminal behavior?
Mr. Johnson?
Mr. Chair and Representative, that's a very complex question, and I'll try to answer it as briefly as I can, because the connection points can be numerous. Insofar as those connection points being within the framework of a records management system and law enforcement and comprehensive law enforcement data, that connection could in fact exist. To the extent that that data is being managed appropriately within the framework of that law enforcement agency, when it is found out that that was used inappropriately as an alias, there are methodologies in which that can be identified, so when that is released, that connection or lack of connection can be identified. To the extent that it appears because an individual was arrested, gave a incorrect name, and created a criminal history, there is a method within the framework of the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension in which a question identity can be handled to ensure that someone who runs that criminal history knows that the individual is originally named is not the true owner of that criminal history.
Representative Champion, any further?
I could go on, but no. I'm a lawyer, you know how I do.
Any other questions at this point? Representative Jackson.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Johnson, it's my understanding that juvenile cases where there is not a referral to adult court are sealed upon the juvenile reaching age of majority. Are those records then permanently sealed, or or is there access through it? And I asked that because I was asked by a constituent about a juvenile case, you know, 7 years prior of vandalism case, showing up in when this individual applied to rent an apartment. So I'm wondering what's the status of that sort of, or should have been the status of that juvenile record.
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair and Representative, again, there may be a number of access points to that data, but Minnesota Statute 260B-171 covers peace officer records of juveniles, and if the record was created for an act of delinquency, that record never becomes public. If the record was created for other than an act of delinquency, that record is public and enjoys no protection whatsoever. So a juvenile event, let's say that involved a public accident, a juvenile that fell off of a bicycle and required medical assistance that the police responded to, that would be a public record. A juvenile who is a suspect in a criminal act, a victim of a criminal act, or committed a criminal act, would enjoy protection under the 261 statute, excuse me. Now, insofar as a criminal history, as a general rule, unless it's an extended juvenile jurisdiction case or one in which the juvenile was certified as an adult, that juvenile record is not publicly released.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is there any way that you could think of that then a juvenile vandalism case 7 years later could show up on an application, as part of the investigation for an application for rent, for renting an apartment?
Well, let's Ms. Fire Kavinsky answer that.
Ms. Fire Kavinsky.
Mr. Chair and Representative, what's likely to have happened in a renting situation is that the juvenile or the person who's now in jail probably consented and said, you can do a background check on me, and here's my informed consent to be able to see any of the data that's not public about me. So the child might not have understood that they were signing that you're going to get to see my juvenile records. Because many people just assume, well, my juvenile record isn't something that someone else is going to be see. But if I sign off and say it's okay, that might be the way that the record might have gone. Thank you.
Mr. Johnson, what is the... There's something that's releasable when the juvenile is like 27 or 28, I think. Is that on an EJJ or?
Mr. Chair, I'm not that familiar with the juvenile records on a criminal history. Okay. I can certainly research that for you, Mr. Chair, and get that information back to you.
You can look that up later. Any other questions at this time? Okay. Go ahead, Mr. Johnson.
Additionally, while we look at comprehensive law enforcement data, as a whole, it should also be understood that there are exceptions within the framework of the statute. Number one, that allow for a law enforcement agency to temporarily withhold incident or response data from public access if that agency reasonably believes that public access would be likely to endanger the physical safety of an individual, cause the perpetrator to flee to avoid detection or destroy evidence. And so there is a definable period of time in which law enforcement could withhold that data for the purposes of completing a criminal investigation under that criteria. And the reverse of that also exists, in which a law enforcement agency, in order to further the law enforcement process, promote public safety, dispel widespread rumor unrest, has the authority to release data that would normally be considered to be not public. And so while many of you may have been watching on TV or listened to the radio or saw in the newspaper levels of information provided by the police, and you may say to yourself, boy, that just doesn't look like that would be public data. That is provided for in order, when the police are seeking the public's assistance in order to further the law enforcement investigative process, or in some cases to help locate suspects and so forth. So the law does provide, under limited circumstances, either the ability to withhold public data under specified circumstances or to release other than public data under specified circumstances. Booking photographs are public data, but again can be temporarily withheld if in fact there's some criminal investigation purpose for withholding that. The general reason behind that is lineups and identification through the process. And finally, that data which law enforcement keeps, that documents how they do their business, how they conduct investigative and other type of law enforcement processes, that is entitled as deliberative processes, and that in fact can be confidential so long as the final actions taken in regard to those processes translated into a public document. So if you had a law enforcement policy, for instance, that delineated how you conducted in the techniques of an undercover operation, clearly it would not be common sense to make that a public document. But if you were conducting a surveillance or a undercover operation, eventually when that came to fruition, what occurred wouldn't in fact become public information. And that is sort of the Reader's Digest version of comprehensive law enforcement data.
Mr. Johnson, would you explain, I don't think you got into the difference between confidential and private.
Well, maybe I, or did you?
Did no. I miss that? Or?
Mr. Chair, I did not, and maybe I'll defer that to, because that classification goes through the entire Chapter 13, so I'll ask Ms. Byer-Kopinski to give that. Sorry.
Mr. Chair, members, when I mentioned that there are a lot of acronyms, a lot of highly defined terms, this is one of them. Most people, if you ask them about data classification, they kind of know confidential, they might know private, they know public, but other than that, most folks don't know. The scheme that Minnesota has is we have data that are about living human beings, so my driving record at public safety. That is private data. So that means that I can see it because it's about me and others who need to do their work and the government can see it. If it was confidential, so say BCA is investigating me, that would be confidential data. So even though it's about me, I can't see it, but other people who need it to do their work can do it. If I were a snowplow at MnDOT, that would be data not on living human beings. It would just be on a machine. So that is likely either going to be public, anyone can have it for any reason, non-public, or protected non-public. So you go private data and non-public are the same thing. If it's about you, you get to see it. So say it's a business. Non-public, private. That means you can have it because it's about you. If it's something that you can't see even though it's about you, if you're a snowplow, that's protected non-public. If you're a human being like me, that's confidential. And public data in both categories, anyone can see for any reason.
Would you explain protected non-public again?
Protected non-public would say if there was a criminal investigation about embezzlement going on at a certain company, or say something along those lines. Something, say a business who is being investigated for, say, civil wrongdoing or criminal wrongdoing. It would be data that government might have, like Blaine Police Department, that they weren't allowed to see. So that would be protected non-public data. It's not about a human being. It's about something that's not alive, like a business or a snowplow. It's that one of the... That's why we're trying to give you the easy stuff first.
Okay. Any questions up to this point?
Now I know you're dying.
Now we get tough.
No. Now we'll go through the quiz and see how everybody did. Now the first one is, okay, I'm a government employee at Department of Admin. In which of these situations is my name and my home address going to be public? And if you guys want to shout out your answers, that'd be great. At the Department of Administration, you'll get my name, but they won't give my home address out. That's protected personnel data. It's private personnel data. At my child's school, the answer to that, and as Representative Mulray highlighted, it depends. Depends on the school districts I'm in. Am I at a private school that's not even subject to these laws at all, or does my school, if it's a public school, do they have directory information under the federal law that says names of parents and home addresses of parents are going to be public? Because if they do, then you're going to be able to go to the public school my daughter goes to and get my home, my name and home address. Okay, the car accident I got into outside of the school that my daughter goes to, my name and address on that police report, all public. Now, this one's a little harder. On my fishing license at DNR, what does everyone think?
Yes.
Not anymore.
Mm-hmm. Representative Mori, it not anymore. At least for the time being. That data come, it used to be that all the data at DNR was all public because they collected it directly from people. And then at one point, they changed their computer system so that instead of collecting it directly from the person, they collected a driver's license number, and then they went to Public Safety, who's covered by the Federal Driver's Privacy Protection Act. They got it from Public Safety, which now prevents that data from being re-released. Someday, I know that DNR hopes to be able to have a database that is clean of that tie from Public Safety, and hopefully they will have names and addresses of hunting and fishing license people being public again so that people who need to buy them for campaigns can do that. Okay, my yoga class at the school district. No, that's protected. That's social recreational data, so my name and home address in that context is not going to be public. Now, this one I had to think about. The donations I make to the U of M or to the Raptor Center. The U of M is subject to the Data Practices Act, and they do have a section. So what it looks like is, likely my name is going to be public. Pretty much my address is going to be public as well, but you won't get to see exactly how much I give. My dollar amount will be put in a range. But it's really difficult to see whether or not it's very clear that my address is or isn't going to go out. But there is some protection for that, and it's something I had never thought of. County property records, is my name and address going to be public?
Yes.
Yep, it is. On my attorney license.
Yes.
Your what?
My attorney license.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Name, yes. Your home address,
no. I'll go back to who, Representative Mulray and members, who is the guy to access, sorry, it's getting late. Doesn't apply to the judicial branch. My attorney license comes from the judicial branch. So, not public government data. It may be public, and it might be I've chosen what address they're going to make public, but the courts have their own rules of access, and it's not a data practices question. Okay, my letters to Mayor Coleman. Yes or no? Or maybe.
Maybe on your letter.
This is really one of those, Representative Mulray and members, this is one of those interesting ones because you have passed a law, Minnesota Statute 13.601, that says correspondence between to and from an elected official, either party gets to decide if they want to make it public. So I could make my correspondence with Mayor Coleman public, or he could. So you kind of have that choice. So when you write to me, think about that.
Representative Westrom.
The reverse is also, he could also decide not to.
Mr. Chair, Representative Westrom, that is true.
He
could decide not to make it public.
Let me go one level deeper. What if, Mr. Chair, what if he, does he have to be consistent in that? Can he say, I don't let any constituent letter contacts out, or every one could be a case-by-case basis?
Mr. Chair, members, typically it's a case by case. Anyone can make a decision about any particular letter that they get. And oftentimes I don't think our people who write to their legislators or their elected officials, I don't know that they're thinking that this is something, you know, when you give your entire problem that you'd hope that your elected official would solve, I don't know that they would expect that the elected official could make it public. But they can.
Would that apply to us as well as elected officials?
Mr. Chair, members, Representative Westrom, it only applies if you send it to, your correspondence goes to a government entity that is subject to the Data Practices Act, because the Data Practices Act doesn't apply to you unless you send stuff to us. Then it does, and then we get to decide if we're going to make your stuff public or not. Okay. How much I make at the Department of Administration? Is it public at admin? Yes. But it's not going to be public at revenue, thank goodness. So what you're going to see, and what I wanted to highlight for you, is that the same exact data can be in multiple places and get very, very different treatment. Commissioner Champion, when he got appointed to be Commissioner of Public Safety, if you ask Public Safety for his home address, they're not going to be able to give it to you. If you go to the Secretary of State's office, his appointment letter is going to have his home address on there. So
just get used to this, that we don't always treat the same data the same. Just like Representative Jackson, we don't treat all kids the same sometimes. We, you know, in different contexts, people's data is going to be public, and you wouldn't expect that. So kind of get used to that, like you're not going to have this nice tight packages.
So I have a question, and I have for Krupinski. So then either the governor or lieutenant governor, if they're where they listed as their home address, is public then? If at, for instance, Secretary of State or...
Mr. Chair and members, I think that in your application of candidacy, I think that you list, I think in that context, the governor's address when he signs up to be a candidate is going to be listed and it would be public. At least I think I've never done a notice of candidacy before, so I think that oftentimes you have to provide your home address to prove you live in the state or prove you live in a specific district.
I think so. Any other questions at this point? Okay, go ahead.
Yep, we're all done. Feel free to call with your questions, because I hope this has really whetted your appetite and that we'll have a lot of fun this session. Thank you.
Members, there's one of the members of the public is just walking out, asked for 5 minutes. apparently, he's not interested in it anymore.
Chris?
You want 5 minutes to... You asked for 5 minutes, so...
Just a couple.
Okay. You will... Those of you that haven't been on the committee before will see Mr. Neumeister quite often when we're dealing with data practices. And,
Mr.
So I thought that he asked for 5 minutes.
No, I was just at a couple minutes. Before you, I just want you to know, this is my second time around on this particular committee, so it's...
I'm here again.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I just wanted to take a moment, and particularly with new members. I am someone who has a citizen for no money at all, and has a long institutional memory of the data practices that Acton has as it's come about. I think it's a very important law. It's where you, the legislator, in open process, decide what is public, what is private, and what is confidential. And where all the parties, citizens, newspapers, I mean, all the parties can come and help make the policy, rather than, like in some other states, it's done by the court. So I think that's an important thing, and as the previous speakers may have said, it's been a long kind of thing. Secondly, I want to let the new members know, as a citizen, I work with all kinds of folks. I may have a different opinion on legislation, but I'll give you both sides of it, and I'm sure that would happen. But I just wanted to take for a few moments to be able to share that, and particularly from an institutional kind of thing. I'm someone that can tell you how this came about, or reason why, or why do we have this, or whatever. And there's a couple other people who've been around for a while, too, but at least I'm one of those as a citizen. So thank you very much for a few moments of your time.
Thank you. Before we adjourn, anything you leave on the table is going to be tossed, so if you want to put anything or have it saved, put it in the save folder. And the notice of the next meeting is obviously wrong. There is no Wednesday, January 18th, and we're not having the next meeting in 2008. So because of all of the cancellations due to holidays or meetings over at the Humphrey Institute, our next meeting will be Wednesday, January 21st. So, yes, 8:30. Okay, has anybody else got anything? Okay, meeting's adjourned.